Hi, everybody. Today's pre-accident podcast is brought to you by Underwriters Laboratory, Worker Health and Safety. Now, they've got a new 11-module program, and the entire reason they're sponsoring the podcast is to introduce you to these modules.
So the first title we're going to release is more informational for organizations, and it's really designed to help educate the entire population related to the new view of safety. So we get into looking at how the best-in-class organizations are utilizing these techniques to drive improvement, but ultimately set up the rest of the content that will be coming online at the end of the first quarter. This first module will be available for free, and we'll announce soon when you're able to access that content as well as where. Thank you.
All this at ulworkplace.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast.
Is this the world-famous John Ausbaugh?
Is this the world-famous and award-winning Todd Conklin?
Top 10 podcaster in government and boring crap category?
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your lovely host. I'm Todd Conklin. I am so excited about this episode of the podcast, I can barely contain myself. And by contain myself, I mean, you know, hold myself in. I almost always contain myself. I mean, I'm always dressed in something, thank God. But today, I think you're going to have a good time. How's it going? So how's the year of slow shaping up? Because I can tell you my goal for this year to go slow and enjoy life, and which these are great goals. There's nothing wrong with this goal at all, except that it's really stinking hard. And I'm having a hard time doing it. It was way easier to be nice to people or be, to be thankful. 1 year I bought somebody lunch every day. Those are easy goals. This goal, slowing down, is hard because you have to really think about, okay, not everything is important. And doing things slowly is often quite pleasant. Even though our society, I don't know what that means, but the people I hang out with and places where I go, there seems to be a real value in, doing stuff as efficiently as possible. Just getting stuff done as quickly as possible. Get it done as quickly as you possibly can. So that's kind of where I am on this. This podcast this week is nuts. I think you're going to like it. It's on the DevOps side of the house. Now, for those of you guys that don't know, DevOps is kind of this notion. These are my words, but kind of web reliability. It's how people who run websites and web-based businesses and web-based functions keep that web system working. And there's going to be a lot of DevOps people listening to this one for sure. So, I mean, I'm not going to even pretend to describe it. But it's so cool to me how this fits into what we do fits into what they do, or what they do fits into what we do. And it depends on where you are, whether you're a we or a they. But I love this idea of reliable systems and how important these reliable systems are, whether you're flying a plane or piloting a tugboat, or you're a safety guy in a plant someplace, or whatever you do, right? This idea that systems need to be reliable is really pretty vital to what we want to do. And that's what we're going to talk about. And it stars a guy named John Ausbaugh. John's been in system operations and DevOps and the computer side of the house for a really super long time, and he's done a ton of stuff. He talks about his background. He sort of built the backing infrastructures, kind of the backside of websites like Salon and InfoWorld and Friendster and Flickr, and he talks about all these. And he's now at Etsy, and he's actually the VP, the vice president of tech at Etsy, and he's got so much to say, and that's all really interesting. But what's really cool about John is that he's become really fixated in after-action reviews and after-action learning. He actually calls them awesome postmortems. But mostly what John has done is kind of gone on this journey to look at and understand how highly reliable systems actually become highly reliable systems, and most importantly, how they maintain their ability to be a highly reliable system. Either way, I think you're going to like this podcast. Whatever you do hardly matters. It all translates across itself. Systems are systems are systems. And any place where a person interfaces with a system, we have the potential for us to have a podcast. And that's exactly the kind of crap we've done. I'll have more to talk about, I'm sure. But I don't want to drag this on too much longer because you're going to love this podcast. So without much further ado, will you please welcome to the podcast the world famous John Ausbaugh. How many Twitter followers do you have, or Twitterites, Twitter people? How many Twitter followers do you have?
I think I'm going to check right here. We were joking the other day because I think I got more than my CEO. I mean, my CEO. I got 14,400.
Holy buckets. You're like a rock star kind of.
Yeah, that's kind of a lot. I mean, I'm no, Ashton Kutcher or anything. Or
Justin Bieber.
Or Justin Bieber, yeah. But 14,000 is nothing to sneeze at.
No, you got to be careful. You can't say anything really controversial actually, you can. It's Twitter. You're supposed to, but you got to be. You can't make 10,000 people mad at once.
I know. I think you'd be surprised.
there's a lot of social.
Just want to point out, Sydney's got 698. So I think I beat Sydney. That'll be great. It's one thing that I'm better at.
Yeah, see, you got him. You got him right there. I mean, that right there. That's alone. That's enough. I mean, actually, job is done. So give me your background. So you really come out of the DevOps that side of the house? How did this all start on the DevOps side for you?
Oh well, I don't know how. It's a good question. How far do you want me to go back?
I don't know. I would stay in the category that it's interesting to listen to. That's usually what I try to stay in the category. But almost everything about you is pretty interesting.
Oh, well, thanks.
You're welcome.
That's just what the funny paper says. All right. So I can see if I could zoom from somewhat beginning up to maybe about 10 years or so. My undergraduate was in mechanical engineering. Actually worked for the U.S. government in a research lab in Cambridge, the Boltby National Transportation System Center. And I was doing, out of college, I was doing vehicle crash worthiness simulations, so dummies and airbags and seatbelts and all of that sort of thing.
Oh, what a cool job. That sounds cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. Yeah, and so, as it turns out, it costs a lot of money to crash a car with all those sensors and dummies and that sort of thing. And if you screw it up, well, you just put you just crashed a car and you can't use the data. So the whole idea was to start doing some mathematical modeling of it and some simulation on computers. So that's where I learned Unix. After about 4.5 years of that, the work was really fun. Kind of looked up and said, wow, I sure do work with a lot of really old white dudes. Maybe there's other things I could do. And the internet was becoming a thing. So I moved from Boston to San Francisco. And that's when I just started doing the software stuff sort of full time. I don't know. I mean, I moved to San Francisco and the original .com boom, I think 98, I'd worked at a whole bunch of different places, some like online magazines, and I did some consulting and some like security stuff. I went to go work at a social networking site that not a lot of people still remember called Friendster. It was a pretty typical startup, an idea took off and there was lots of people trying to hit this website at the same time. And so there's all sorts of, well, how many servers do you have? And is there enough capacity to have all the functionality and that sort of thing? So I learned a lot there, largely about operations we're responding to outages, responding to various things that go bump in the night, like data centers going down or hurricanes taking out network routers and all that sort of thing. And then I when I left Friendster, I went to go work at Flickr, which was basically another version of the story, which was this photo sharing website that really that took off. And then from there, I went at that point. Flickr was bought by Yahoo, so I got to see a whole range of different organizations from the front page of Yahoo to Yahoo Mail and sports and finance and all of the sort of the, run the whole gamut. And then after that, somebody tricked me, I mean, convinced me to come work at Etsy and move to New York. And so throughout that whole bit there at Flickr, it became clear. So I was one of, I think, 9 people in this tiny little company in Vancouver when the company was bought by Yahoo. And I was the only real operations person that was working there. And so monitoring and alerts and metrics collection and getting graphs and dashboards and all that stuff was in my wheelhouse. And so, but there was something that we were doing, which was because the team was so small, there was a lot more generalists going on, right? And even the small team that I built in hiring, what you would call back then, what you would call ops people, or really people who are focused on this, sort of building the infrastructure, the servers, and even sort of the lower levels of the software infrastructure. You had to know a lot more. It wasn't, this big company. Even though we were part of a big company, Yahoo, within our sort of organization, you really did have to know a lot about all of these overlapping areas. And so about around 2009, my friend Paul Hammond, who I was working with at the time, I guess I was leading the ops team, and Paul was leading the the development team. We gave this talk at a conference called Velocity, which you spoke at earlier this year.
Yeah, it's really a fun conference too. It's very fun.
Yeah, and there was a rough idea, and it turns out a couple of people, not just Paul and I, a couple of people arrived at the same, some of the same questions, or at least some of the same the things that we thought were interesting was, hey, why is it? It's weird that you put this group of engineers in charge of this area, and this group of engineers in charge of this other area, and the real cartoonish way is to think, okay, well, this group here, they're in charge of building features and fixing bugs and what they call, you can't see it, but I'm doing air quotes as I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
we can see them.
Product development. And so this is all of the software that users see and customers see. And then this other group over here sees everything that's like behind, the back office or underneath it all that makes it work. So we wanted to start thinking about, there was enough difference between how we did things at Flickr and other organizations that it said, hey, well, either we're doing it wrong and everybody else is doing it correct, or maybe our definition of what's correct is a lot more malleable, a lot more, and maybe it's a lot more squishy than we think. And a couple months later, after we gave this talk in 2009, with a guy named Patrick Dubois, and completely separately, he and another guy named Andrew Schaefer arrived at this idea of this agile view, or what would it look like if agile, which was agile is the word that you referred to the Agile Manifesto, and this agile software development, sort of this methodology or way of thinking about software development. What if you did that, but in the infrastructure stuff, not just in the feature stuff? So it's a little bit of like peanut butter and chocolate. And what happens if you put this stuff together and made it so that, the people in the pit crew knew as much about driving the car as the driver does, and the driver knew as much as the pit crew did about how the car works.
And you double that up, this notion of agile probably infers at least to highly adaptive, highly resilient, all the kind of words that we all think about when we think about how systems operate. Fair enough?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the core of it, the idea was well, hey, you know, we could be wrong about this, but it's possible that there's an advantage in not having these sharp lines. Here's where my domain, like here's where my domain ends, and here's where yours begins, and here's where my focus of attention ends, and here's where yours begins.
So, John, let me ask you a question. Were you destroying the stovepipes in a traditional sort of organizational view? Or were you sort of creating, were you flattening the organization so that knowledge existed throughout the organization?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I can tell you this. We did not purposely and actively design this. What happened was, you know, Flickr needed to grow and Yahoo bought Flickr. And then at some point, we kind of looked up and said, hey, we've been doing this for like 4 years and nobody's caught on fire and the world, you know, the world hasn't ended yet. And maybe this way of working could work. And it was sort of like just a recognition that organically we had just showed up there. But it wasn't like, okay, you sat down at the very beginning, it's like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to revolutionize the way software is built. And this person, you know, does this thing, but we're going to flip it on its head. Like it wasn't a purposeful, you know, I don't think any of us knew anything about organizational design or organizational psychology or really anything. It just did. It just worked. And nobody was there to tell us we were doing it wrong. And so we just kept doing what we were doing. But then we recognized, hey, there's like a contrast between what we were doing and this other group. So sometimes when people say, well, hey, John, how did you do that? How did you make that transformation at Flickr from the old way and maybe the siloed way into this new way? I say, you know, I'm actually really, you're asking the wrong guy. Because number one, I was kind of in charge. And so I didn't have to fight anybody on it. And everybody else, there was really no disagreement about it. And number two is, I think you think that we did this on purpose. We didn't.
So it's this emergent phenomenon. It's really this emergent organizational structure for reliability that you guys accidentally sort of created or organically created, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Did you carry that on to Etsy?
Well, yeah. We did. And when I moved to Etsy, it was a different type of challenge because here was this company that had been around. Actually, I didn't start it. I didn't build. You know, I was to inherit a whole bunch of technology, a whole bunch of staff. A bunch of practices that I didn't design. And whether somebody else designed them, you know, deliberately or not, the fact still remains that I had to, you know, I had to do with what was already there and was already been there for a couple of years. And some of it is great and some of it might not be great. And so that was kind of the challenge I wanted to have, which is, okay, well, if I wasn't, you know, if I didn't invent it all, like, how would I know what to discard and rebuild and what to keep? And that's a hard question. It's a pretty good challenge. But, I mean, generally speaking, there's a couple of sort of principles that I kept. When I came to Etsy and thankfully is almost sort of like a big kind of validation experiment And some of the things that I honestly, when I started at Etsy, you know, there was maybe at most maybe 16 or I think 16 or 17 or so engineers total at Flickr, and a couple hundred. I don't think I would have, when I first started Etsy, if you asked me, okay, well, in about 5 years, are some of these practices still going to work? I would have said, God, no, definitely not. Turns out, it is.
Wow. So, that's quite amazing. So what do you think about when you think about creating this robust, reliable system, this system that has the ability to learn from itself and develop and grow? I mean, in many ways, you guys bring to the table this incredible opportunity to really look at and manage these high-consequence systems in a way that, I don't know, people don't die at the end. I mean, that part's interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, two thoughts. The first is that there's this, and I've talked with a lot of companies who are looking to do something that's, you know, specific to their company, but something similar along the lines. And I think one of the challenges that people have, and it's not a challenge that you decide, okay, well, we're going to do it this way, and then you never, you know, you never have second thoughts or you never revisit it. Like, it's a thing that you kind of have to keep. You have to, like, you got to feed it and you have to cultivate it. But this idea that that you have to accept that things are messy and that the cost, let me contrast two different worlds. One world is where I've got a job and I know exactly the boundaries of my job. Here's where the input comes in and I do my thing. And then here's where the output goes out, right? Total, like a Tayloristic cartoon. Okay?
Gotcha.
And here's my boundaries. And, you know, if something happens, if something goes wrong or whatever outside of my boundaries, I get to put my hands up in the air and say, look, you know, I did my part, must be somebody else's deal. And so on the one hand, good Lord, that is, I can imagine, look how tempting that is, because if I can put domain expertise and if I could say, all right, well, here's this employee number and here's their name, even in a super empathetic and very personal way, well, here's Lisa Smith and here's Stephen Jones and they're very nice people and we can be really cordial and really have a pleasant place to work, but I can almost put them in cells in a spreadsheet if that's the world that you live in. And so, but the problem is that you just, the world doesn't work that way and you can't plan. Like, plans are the limitations of planning for things, just really just breaks down. And that's, in my mind, I can't unsee that. That's that type of world is so incredibly just brittle, especially these days. I mean, contrast that with another world where, all right, I know network engineering. I know, you know, I know all the protocols and I know a lot of the hardware and I know a lot about, I just got a deep domain expertise, let's say, in networking. But the thing is if I make it so that, you know, let's set the expectation. You got to talk to this application developer. Well, no application. If an application is important these days, it talks on a network. So if I say, look, you know, if I were a grand designer of an organization, I said, look, network engineer person and application developer person, you guys just got to, you know, just figure out where your stuff touches and think about all the things that you want to consider when you're designing something, about all the things that you want to do once it shows that it can break in one way or another way or that sort of thing. And then if you just say, we're not going to dictate and we're not going to prescribe that this is the edge of your expertise and you're free to get all up in each other's business, and just let your professionalism work out, you know, where the, you know, where the responsibility, where the knowledge, the domain knowledge lies, then I'm convinced you'll have a better outcome. And so that's I think is the, but there's a downside. There's no free lunch. The downside is, unlike the first world that I described, which gives me the illusion that it's all predictable, and I can just tell what the future is going to look like because, just everything works the way it's supposed to, or the way I proceduralized it to. In the messy world, the second world I described, it just means that there's a lot of like, hey, are you going to do? No, I can do that. No, are you going to? I thought you were going to. No, okay, I'll do it. I'll do that, and then how about this? I'll do that, and then you do this other thing, and then let's check. I'll show you the stuff that I did, and you tell me if it'll work with the stuff that you're working on, because I know a little bit about what you do, and you know a little bit about what I do, and we'll just reconcile it. We'll just repair any misunderstandings we've got, and we'll just make sure that it works together. So it takes a lot of effort, and it's a lot less simple. We're relying a lot more on social contracts than we are, like objective.
Are they reliable? Are social contracts like that reliable? Because the first world, the world of control, kind of assumes social contracts are, not reliable, that you have to have structure, control, you have fine lines, distinct divisions. When you leave it up to improvisation, like you kind of do, do you get a reliable product? Do you get a better product, maybe?
Well, I'm convinced. I will assert the answer is yes, absolutely, because it looks a lot more like, even if there are rough set out expectations, but not prescriptive stuff, the messiness is what makes it work. And you said reliable. Is that reliable? Well, I don't know if I agree. I don't know. You didn't say this, but I don't know if I would ever agree that there's such a thing as it's either reliable or it's not reliable.
Ah,
because there's a whole spectrum of what reliable is.
So there are shades of reliability. Now you're bringing – now that's interesting. That's interesting at every level.
Yeah, and in the case of – let's just take these two people, these two hypothetical people that I'm talking about, application developer and a network engineer. What they – first of all, is their definition – Is each of their definitions of reliable the same? And in all of the contexts that they're in?
That's a great question.
What you're left with, they got to reconcile that stuff. Nobody's more expert in reconciling their goals and their understanding of how each other work than they are. They are the experts in that. They own their own relationship.
So what hints do you have then for somebody who's looking at leading an organization or leading a safety program or a reliability program or an uptime kind of program? What hints do you have to help them sort of move in this direction?
I'll steal from you, and I'll steal from Sydney. And that is to say, look for the absence of bad things. Look for the presence of good things. And so, if you're willing to take the plunge and say, all right, you know what, I'm gonna give it a shot. I'm going to give it a shot at not trying to prescribe all of the behavior and all of the procedures and all that sort of thing. Procedures, we won't throw them away, but just recognize that they're guidelines to be used just like any other resource in getting a job done. And I'm okay, let's say, I'm okay with it being messy. So after some period of time, find all of the things that the people involved would say, yeah, we really rocked that one thing. That one thing was real cool. But then look in that one thing. What are the ingredients that went into that thing that was a success? That project that totally took off and, against the odds of it not going well. And then figure out. And I think every time that in my experience, every time I see that, what I find are application developer and a network engineer, for example, who knows a good deal, not everything, but a good deal about how each other work and what keeps each other up at night and those sorts of things. So then I would say that, you know, my hint, the one that I've been working on, my MO at the moment is to detect when that's happening. So when I see somebody, even in a meeting or an email thread, somebody says, oh, hey, you know what? You know who we're talking about doing X or Y or Z? You know what we should do? We should talk to so-and-so because did you know that they're working on this thing that's totally related? And it might not mean anything, but maybe we could steal some ideas from them, or maybe they know that this one way that we're trying to build this product won't work because they've got this other experience. And every time I see that sort of connection happen, especially when it's way cross functional, when customer support's looped in or finance is looped in, and you're like, oh yeah, we should probably ask that person. That's when I know that there's the seeds of the messiness working out are firmly in place.
That's kind of cool. So what got you fixated, and you're really passionately fixated around this notion of post-event learning, or you call them awesome postmortems, which is even the best, like that's clearly the title of your soon-to-be-written book, I'm sure. Why are you interested in that idea?
Well, I had always been interested in, I hadn't really, I mean, I think like anybody, there's like anybody who's ever had either worked with engineers or has done engineering. I mean, I think maybe this is the main reason why reenactments on the History Channel so damn interesting.
And they are interesting. I agree.
Really, yeah. Failure is real interesting, right? There's sometimes villains, sometimes there's heroes. And so these are just stories. But it wasn't until I had worked at Yahoo that I was sort of introduced the idea of like a formal AAR or like a formal debrief. And I got into it and I said, well, okay, well, I figured, I want to get good at this. I don't want any learning to be, dropped on the floor. And I started thinking about it and I bought it all hook, line, and sinker. And I was giving this talk, actually, I remember it clear as day. I was giving this talk about 6 or 7 years ago, about 7 years ago. And I was giving this talk and I said, oh yeah. And then here's how you do it. You do it this. And then you put a category. Here's the place in the postmortem document where you put the category. And here's the category. The category is, loss of capacity. It was a hardware failure. It was a software failure. And it was human error. And I remember giving this talk, and I'm all proud of myself. I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. My slides are great. My jokes are going over real well.
They're hilarious. I'm hilarious.
And I'm feeling all smug. And there's one guy at the sort of towards the end of the talk says, "Hey, so tell me about this human error category, and tell me how that's just not a big, asterisk, like a big wild card. Like basically, how is any of those things not human error? Like, why don't you just call it all human error?" And I thought, well, good God, this guy totally's got me stopped in my tracks. I have, you know, I don't have a real good answer. And he kept answering good. He kept asking really good questions. And I don't think, I don't know if I had ever been so flummoxed. And so I said, well, clearly I don't know anything. I got to figure out how this is going to go. And then I start reading. For some period of time, at least in software operations, every now and then a book will come and make the rounds in the community. And at the time, Perro's book of Normal Accidents was making the rounds. And it was helpful. Man, big book. And it was helpful. I didn't really know at the time that it was much more of an anti-nuclear book than it was about 50.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, you know, he was referencing other people, and I had to pull on those threads and pull on those threads. Not too far that I get. It's not too too long before you run across Decker. And at the same time, I had read a paper, a really short paper called "How Complex Systems Fail" by Richard Cook,
thought,
"Oh man, I must." How did I never heard of this guy? This guy Cook is really this guy must be at Google, right? And I was like, oh yeah, this is Dr. Richard Cook. Oh, he must be a PhD in, you know, distributed systems or something like that. Oh no, wait, what? He's an anesthesiologist. Hold on a second here, and that's what, you know, that's what brought me to spend way too much money on Ashgate and what. So I jumped at the chance when I found that that Sydney's program at Lund University was sort of built for practitioners, and so there was no way I wasn't going to do that. And whatever, years later, so that's the sort of the origin story. But it was largely driven by not having good answers. Like, and these were legit questions. There was nobody in my field who had good answers, or really any answers.
Right.
Just goes to show how much how easy and like seductive that sort of thinking, sort of that old view thinking can be. I mean, it's really satisfying, and super, super simple. Look, human error. I know, right? Roll your eyes.
And it creates a really strong cognitive bias. And remember, the enemy of the question is always the answer. So if you have a good answer, human error, boom, done, finished. No more thought needed. Fix the person, go on. Well, I, for one, am so excited that you guys are in this community. I just think it's, you guys bring such a depth and dimension. And DevOps people are so systems focused anyway that it's, I think it's an amazing, amazing thing. What if you could give some hints, things you've learned? What are a couple things that you think are sort of the gold nuggets of this kind of new view thinking?
Oh, boy, that's a tall order.
You want me to give you mine? I can give you mine, and then you can go off those. So I always think there's two things. One is that I don't think we spend near enough time with management, with leadership, bringing them up around the fundamentals of this new thinking. So I always think that's really a weakness. If we don't spend the time and energy bringing our leaders into this worldview, they won't magically get there. And then the other thing I think, if I picked a gold nugget, is we have to do better postmortems. Those are my two. Those are my go-tos.
I can riff on that, and I'll give you a big yes and to those two. I think maybe to add on that is, and it's a little bit of a Trojan horse, I think, is that by doing, and I'm convinced of this, by doing, here's nugget number one, by doing good postmortem debriefings, getting good at asking questions, getting good at facilitation, getting good at capturing that stuff, not with like a singular focus on prevention, but a singular focus on learning, and that's it. If it results in prevention, rock on. But if it doesn't, then I think learning should be the sort of the primary goal. By doing that and getting good at it, I think people will note that the good ones actually do more about getting descriptions of how normal work happens, right? And that accidents are just really just a quick like a bookmark, sort of a kick in the butt to say, hey, you might not know about how things normally work as well as you think you would. And so there was obviously some surprise here. That surprise comes from a contrast from normal. So go look at, go take a look. Not going to get it all, but go take a look. So I like the idea that by focusing on postmortems, or at least elevating or evolving our abilities to do it, in a thoughtful and careful way, ideally we'll get to know what normal work looks like, because I think that's really the goal, I think.
I think that's excellent.
Number two, I think, and this is the thing that I think is really hard sometimes, and I have to remind myself a lot in software, is remember software engineers spend all day, every day, engaged in an activity that promises absolutely reproducible and repeatable results with ridiculous amounts of precision and accuracy. You write a piece of code that writes 2 + 2 = 4. You are for 8 hours or plus a day, you're surrounded with the idea that you will always get 4, no matter how many millions of times and millions of times per second you run that piece of code. So it can lull you into thinking that outcomes are predictable and can be predictable. And so and because of that, it tends to ignore how much judgment, how much gut calls, how much emotion and how much like experience, how much tacit knowledge engineers have as they're writing code. Just like Kerouac is writing, you know, on the road, he's thinking about the structure of the sentence. It's really not all that much different than, it's not magic. Software engineers are writing code to perform something. And so it's in the process of getting a machine to do something exactly the way you want it to, you can sometimes completely skip over how much judgment you are imbuing, like how much opinion unvalidated, unconfirmed, just messy opinion human stuff that goes into code. And I think software developers, really, I think, skip over that. But know it in their core, but don't talk about it, because then that will give us this idea that the code that we're writing might not actually be, deemed objectively true at all times. I just talked a lot at you.
No, you kind of sort of blew my mind. I mean, I really liked what you had to say, because I'm thinking about it a lot, because we get lulled by the precision into the belief that the system is stable, because the system's stable, and we sort of close off the ability to understand that that's always underpinned by this notion of sort of human judgment, human expertise.
Yeah. And a lot of that, and the tacit part of that, what was the quote that I was reading the other day that about tacit knowledge? We can know more than we can tell.
Yeah.
So what went into that piece of software you wrote today, that it, make no mistake, it went into the, your thinking went into writing that piece of code. But how weird is it that you probably would have a tough time if if it's even possible, tell me how you thought about it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
It's a bit weird, and it's just messy, and you just have to get ready, you know, just like any, you just have to, I think the thing we need to embrace is that there is no such thing as, like, we can't be certain. We're long past the idea that we're writing software that provides us any amount of certainty.
Kapow! We're long past the idea that we're writing software that provides any amount of certainty. Holy guacamole. So, I hope you can hear that. The audio is really soft on that. I'm sorry. John was in New York City. It was right before the big giant Snowzilla or Snowmageddon or Snowmahal or whatever. And we were all tucked in and trying to get this recorded. But I hope you enjoyed it. It's longer than the normal. I know that. It's a good 15 minutes longer. I'm sorry about that, too. But, God, what would you cut out of there? Come on, talk to me about this. I thought this was remarkable. There's a couple things that just come to mind. One is this notion that we're past the thinking of certainty. Now we're thinking about sort of systems as what they are, sort of this human to technical interface that's rife with potential to fail. And then this whole idea around tacit knowledge, I'm sure you're going to hear more about this as well. That is the Pre-Accident Podcast for today. As always, I hope you learned something new every day. You did today. Have a lot of fun. And for goodness sakes, be safe.